Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for your word. Thank you that you care about us and you see us and you're for us. This morning, Lord, I pray that you would speak through me and in spite of me. And as we engage this conversation that Jesus is having, I pray that we would be as impacted by it as if we had been there. That Spirit, you would bring this text to life, this account to life, that we might see Jesus and respond to him faithfully. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so I'm going to start out and just say, let's start a little different than I thought. So today we're in a series called Life-Changing Conversations, Life-Changing Convos. And for the record, again, we're not arrogantly claiming that our sermons are life-changing. Okay. I'm not saying that. Don't hear that because that's not what I'm saying. This series is on interactions between Jesus and other people that we're going to look at. And we believe that his conversations with those people were life-changing. And that as we engage those conversations, that they might change our life as well. As a church, we believe that even though technology is rapidly changing and politics are constantly changing and that the world moves much faster than it used to, we believe that there are some things that haven't changed. Again, we don't believe Jesus or his core gospel message has changed. In the New Testament, it says that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. We also don't believe that humans have changed that much either, that all of us are moving through our lives and we're searching and we're hungry and we're looking for things like identity and security. We still have needs that only God can truly meet. And that that as humans, we still look to things like money and sex and romance and power to meet those needs, but they never quite fully meet the need. And so we believe there's much that we can learn as we study the way that Jesus interacted with people like you and I, people who are broken yet beautiful, people that had a ton of issues and problems and sins, who also had incredible potential to be the people that God longed for them to be. And so to kick us off, again, I'm talking about the fact that we're broken and beautiful. I'm going to talk about the broken part of our life a little bit. But if you're here today and you have ever been in a romantic relationship, have you ever gotten a fight with your partner before? Anyone? Okay. Okay. Four of us. That's good. Okay. The rest of you guys should be on the marriage ministry team because you would really help. I remember one of my wife, Jackie, who's up here doing the kids ministry time. We had one of our all-time low fights in a place that's supposed to be romantic. We were in Paris. I know. And we were on our way back actually from Africa. And we had booked this hotel with credit card points. And honestly, it was a lot nicer than I thought it would be. We were feeling pretty blessed in terms of accommodations, especially as people who never thought we would travel that far ever growing up. And there was a restaurant in the hotel and they'd kind of been promoting this like 5-course prefix meal. And again, this hotel just seemed nicer than it cost us. And I thought maybe the meal will be nicer than it had cost us. And one night we were like, why not? You know, we were only there 2 nights. So the second night we were like, you know what, let's just try it. And Jackie wanted to, and it seemed romantic, you know, and I was pretty excited. And they started bringing the food out. And I'll be honest with you, the first dish was not my favorite, like at all. But I was like, you know what? There's 4 more courses. It's a prefix menu. You know, it's a 5-course menu. We could have a literal course correction here. You know what I'm saying? So this second dish could be tasty. And the second one comes out and it is also not good. And they asked if we wanted to do an upgrade for a certain amount of money that would have cost us like $50 for the third dish. And I turned it down. But it got me thinking, how much is our tab right now? And he said it was $150. And I was thinking, like, this is so expensive already. I know we're in Europe and you don't tip or whatever. We're going to tip. This is like $200. And this isn't a good meal. It's like a top 10 most expensive meal in my life. And it's not good. And the third dish comes out and it's not good. I'm bummed out. I start venting. Right. And by the way, every wife wants a husband who complains about the price of dinner. You know what I'm saying? Right. Every little girl grows up dreaming of marrying a man who will take them to dinner in Paris and spend 20 minutes frantically doing euro to dollar conversions under their breath. Right. Right. Like every Disney prince has a character where he blesses the princess with a cheapskate rant at a restaurant. And then in between this rant about the price, but before the fourth dish comes out, I realize that our tab is not 150, it's 150 per person. This is where things go from bad to worse. I can't handle it. I already felt so betrayed. I already thought the meal wasn't very good. I had already adjusted to the sticker shock only to find out it's only half the price. That blew me away with sadness. And I moved from the spirit to the flesh. Self-control goes out the window. I am shaking my head. I am sighing. I'm like an old man whose favorite baseball team's losing the World Series. You know, I'm just like, At one point, this is embarrassing. I do this. If you saw the faces I was making and the hand gestures I was doing and you didn't have any context clues, you would think I was at a hospital and I just found out a loved one was not doing well. Eventually, Jackie says, if you can't enjoy this meal and are going to be this negative, you can finish the meal by yourself. She excuses herself, goes back up to the room. All-time high for me as a husband. The server comes back and is like, Monsieur, where does your wife go? And I was like, oh, we had a disagreement about the food, like the quality of the food. He was like, was it not good? And I didn't lie. I didn't say she thought this, but I was like, it wasn't good. It wasn't good, you know? Like, she left and it wasn't good. Like, you can fill it in. Again, this is not my best moment, you guys. And he's like, we will take her. It's off the bill. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I did two things. First, I praised God because miracles are real. Then I went and I gave a unqualified apology, which means I said sorry to my wife with no ifs, ands, or buts. After the apology, I was like, hey, but they took the bill off. She's like, I hate you. Stop it. I don't want to know about that discount. My wife then let me know that she'd rather eat a meal with a warm, encouraging husband. She'd rather eat a terrible meal with a warm, encouraging husband than a phenomenal meal with a negative, pessimistic husband. It was honestly a lesson that changed my life. So now, whenever we head into potentially stressful travel situations, she'll say, you didn't pack your Paris attitude, did you? She goes, remember, there's no pressure. You don't have to impress me with a perfect itinerary. Just don't be mean and don't put your hands in your face. And I'm like, nope, right? Now, anyways, aside from trying to trigger Jackie's dining PTSD, I actually asked her to be in kids today for that reason. Why do I tell that story? I tell that story because the reason I was so angry and discouraged was because I genuinely felt taken advantage of. I had high hopes. It's like French food, romantic dinner, prefix, going to try a lot of different things. I've been surprised at how nice stuff had been so far, and I felt so let down. I felt insanely unsatisfied. Now, that story might have been cringy to you, and you might be unsure about being part of a church with a pastor who's this petty and embarrassing and ungrateful, but I've been human long enough, and I've been a pastor long enough, and listened to enough people's stories to know that life in a fallen world is to experience deep dissatisfaction. Like, you have all been there. You can judge me, but you have been there too. You're just not as brave as I am to say it out loud. Just kidding. He had more self-control, but she felt it. Now, again, being unsatisfied is just a reality in this world, right? Like you achieve a goal. You get the attention. You finally took the trip. You made the move. You got the relationship you prayed for. And then it's just okay. Like you were winning, but you were still wanting. You were full, but you were not fulfilled. And I think that's more common than we want to admit. A friend of mine, he planted a church and it grew from 20 people in his parents' house to 4,000 in 8 years. And he ended up writing an article a little while into that. And he said, I've been to the top of the mountain and it's just okay. I've talked to people who made more money than they ever dreamed of making, only to tell me it didn't deal with the thing that made me want a ton of money in the first place. For some of you, you finally got that relationship or you wanted kids or whatever it is, like that thing that you wanted. And then when you got it, it just wasn't enough. And so this morning, what I want to ask is a pretty basic question, but what do we do with our dissatisfaction in life? I want to run through, why are we dissatisfied? What do we do with that? And can Jesus make any difference? And so that's what I'm going to talk about this morning. If you have Bibles, turn to John chapter 4. The first 2 weeks of the series, we looked at a cynical man named Nathaniel. Last week, we looked at an ashamed man named Nicodemus. Today, we don't have the name of this person, but I'm going to call her the unsatisfied gal. The unsatisfied gal. So we're going to be in John chapter 4. You turn there, and we'll be starting in verse 1. It said, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard he was making and baptizing more disciples than John, though Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, he left Judea and went to Galilee. He had to travel through Samaria. He had to travel through Samaria. We'll come back to that. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the property that Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, worn out from his journey, sat down at the well. It was about noon. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. "Give me a drink," Jesus said to her, because his disciples had gone into town to buy food. Verse 9, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" She asked, for Jews do not associate with Samaritans. So a few things here. Jesus's fame is spreading. People are getting jealous. Him and his disciples are on the move. And it says that Jesus went through an area called Samaria, which was a part of Israel that was in between Galilee, where Jesus was from, and the capital, Jerusalem, where the religious and political establishment were. And it was occupied by a marginalized ethnic group called the Samaritans. Samaritans were essentially interracial people, part Jewish, part Philistine, kind of a blend of the groups in the area at that time. They were ethnically and spiritually blended. They also rejected Jerusalem, saying that the temple had been corrupted by the Jewish leaders. So a Samaritan spiritual leader called people to make places like Jacob's well their holy site, where they're at in this moment. These people hated and were hated by the Jewish people. So think America, Deep South, racial animosity. Think throughout history, just different groups where there is ethnic division. I'm blanking on a word, but there's division, there's animosity, there's a history that's gone on and on. Again, there was so much hatred between the groups that Jews would often travel around Samaria instead of go through it when going between Judea and Galilee. Now, that might not sound that crazy. You're like, oh, I like this freeway or I like this freeway. What you need to know is this would have added 5 to 6 days to their journey to take this detour. Right? Like, how bad do you have to hate someone? But in addition to that, Jewish people were often attacked along that road by Samaritan bandits. It's where we get the Good Samaritan story. It was on that road. And they would feel spiritually defiled around all the idolatry. And then so he hits this town called Sychar, which contains an ancient Middle Eastern monument of sorts. According to Jewish, Samaritan, Christian, and Muslim traditions, it's there to this day. This well is there to this day. It's on a piece of land that was given to Jacob by his father back in Genesis 33. There's a monastery there now. There's this well. And the well is the place they believe Jacob used to water his flocks, and it's about 135 feet deep, and so Jesus sits down and he starts talking. And the other thing you need to know is it's hot out. It says it was in the middle of the day. The 6th hour is 12-ish noon, according to ancient Roman timekeeping. And so a couple of things that are interesting about this passage. One, Jesus shouldn't have taken this route. It said that I don't know if you guys saw that, it said he had to travel through Samaria, but I already told you he didn't have to. I think the reason that he had to was because he had to talk to this woman. And so the idea is that Jesus meets us where we are. The other thing that's interesting is that this woman is there in the middle of the day when it's very hot. And then lastly, another thing that's really interesting about this passage is that she asks, you know, why are you talking to me? Because this original audience, this interaction between Jesus and this woman would have been scandalous. Jesus, you know, hanging out by a well, talking to a woman, that might not seem that wild to you today. You probably have never met a Samaritan. There are very few left. You probably don't have a lot of conversations around wells. Maybe you do. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know your story. You might have a well from back in the day. But for most of us, like, what's so scandalous here? And again, there's a few cultural context pieces that are wild. One, she is a woman. Now, again, that might not seem crazy to you, but in the ancient world, very patriarchal society, more than not just patriarchal, it was truly misogynistic in a ton of different ways. Jesus was already known as a holy man. He was known as someone leading a movement to bring Israel back to God. And in that culture, many devout Jewish men would not have allowed themselves to be alone with a woman. If it was unavoidable that they should, they certainly wouldn't have started a conversation. They often tended to view women as only a source of sexual temptation, not as real people with souls and desires and dreams and emotions and lives. But it was the risk of temptation, or more importantly, the risk of gossip or impurity, that just because they were around them, even if something happened, that people would talk about it, which again, is just kind of interesting for Pharisees back in the day, man. They thought they had, you know, as my kids say, mad riz, you know what I mean? They just thought wherever I walk, girls are just going to throw themselves at me, which is a weird thing for this rabbi, just, you know, the thought that. But that's kind of how things were viewed. And you'll see that later in the passage, the disciples are super weirded out when they come back. They're like, why are you talking to her? What happened? Secondly, she's Samaritan, which I described earlier. This was not a positive thing in the eyes of the Jewish community of the day. Again, the ethnic tension was very thick. I mean, you know, think about racism. Jewish leaders would pray out loud at synagogue gatherings. Thank you for not making me a Samaritan, Lord. Crazy. They definitely wouldn't have eaten or drank with them. Again, in the ancient world, to eat with someone was to say, I associate with you and I endorse you, essentially. When Jesus invites people to have meals with him, it's scandalous. It's one of the reasons why the Pharisees want to kill him, because he's supposed to be a holy man eating with prostitutes and tax collectors. You give people their dignity back when you eat meals with them in this context. Now, he's not eating a meal, but he's going to share a cup. I was watching a documentary recently about the greatest team in the history of sports, the Boston Celtics. Most NBA titles, a million reasons. So many reasons. You could do a Celtic song, not a worship song, but a Celtic song. But in it, Bill Russell was the first African-American coach. He was the first black MVP. He was the second player drafted. Celtics are the first team to ever draft a black player, the first team to ever have a all-black starting five, first team to have a black coach. Three out of the five black head coaches who have ever won a title have been Celtics head coaches. I can go on and on, in a city with a ton of racism in it. So it's pretty impressive. Now, Bill Russell used to do this thing. A reporter in the documentary tells a story. He's an old Boston Globe reporter. And he said, I remember it was like 10:30 in the morning and Bill Russell met me for an interview and he ordered a martini at 10:15 in the morning. Okay. And this is a weekday. This isn't a North Park brunch situation. This isn't something people did back then. And Bill Russell used to say, he said, Bill would just said, I love the taste of a martini in the morning. And then he would offer it. He offered it to the reporter. And the reporter drank it or whatever. And he said, Bill said, I always do that to see if white people actually care about me. Will they drink from the same glass? So Jesus, in this moment, he is telling the Samaritan woman, I'm willing to be seen with you. I'm willing to talk to you. I'm willing to give you your dignity back. I'm willing to share a drinking vessel with you. There's so much happening here in terms of honoring and giving her her dignity back in a society that wouldn't have done that. Thirdly, she's not just a Samaritan woman, as we're going to see. She has a ton of sin in her life. At least that would have been the opinion of those who knew her. Whether she is in sin or not doesn't matter in so much as that was the view people would have had, which is why she's there in the middle of the day. This is a culture without cars or air conditioning. And if you're going to go and draw water and carry it back a decent distance, the normal time of day you'd go to fetch the water would absolutely be in the morning before the sun was all the way out. Our family, we've taken a few vacations. We pretty much always go to Palm Springs in the summer, 'cause it's cheap. And you go then, and so one of the things we do is we go out to the pool between 8 and 11 a.m., and then 6 and 11 p.m. In the middle of the day, we are in the house, air conditioning, movies, sleeping. Same idea here. You don't go out in the middle of the day to do this in this kind of heat, but she's doing this. And a lot of scholars think the reason the woman comes at this time of day, when she was least likely to meet anyone, at least anyone who knows her, is there's a good chance she doesn't want to rub shoulders with the judgmental people of the town. And yet here she is, Jesus talking to this woman alone, this woman that other women would have guarded their husbands from or spread rumors about or looked down on. And he's going to share with her the message of who he is and what he has to offer. So after she says, how can you, a Jew, ask me for a drink, a Samaritan? Jesus answers, if you knew the gift of God and who is saying to you, give me a drink, you would ask him and he would give you living water. This is classic Jesus. He's talking to someone about something spiritual, but he's using a physical picture. Last week, Nicodemus, he said, you got to be born again. Remember, Nicodemus was like, am I going to go back to my mom's womb? He's like, no, man, relax, right? We're talking spiritually. It's a metaphor, bro. It's a metaphor. And it's the same way here. She's thinking he's talking about literal water, which we see in verse 11. She says, sir, you don't even have a bucket, and the well is deep. So where do you get this living water? You aren't greater than our father Jacob, are you? He gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and livestock. And so she's pretty annoyed with Jesus at this point. Maybe it's because usually when men talk to her, it's either to condemn her or use her. But either way, and also because Jesus is talking, you know, and he's using a metaphor she can't figure out. Verse 13, Jesus said, everyone who drinks from this water will get thirsty again, but whoever drinks from the water that I will give them will never get thirsty again. In fact, the water I will give them will become a well of water springing up in them for eternal life. Sir, the woman said to him, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and come here to draw water. Go call your husband, he told her, and come back here. I don't have a husband, she answered. You have correctly said, I don't have a husband, Jesus said. For you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. Dang. Jesus seemingly reveals where she's at here and what she's looking for. Likely the reason she's there in the middle of the day, the truth she's hiding. And what's shocking is Jesus knows it all and he doesn't turn away from her. He doesn't shame her. He wants more for her, as you'll see, than how she's living. But he doesn't condemn her. He invites her into something beautiful. He gently reveals her thirst and offers something better. But now this water talk makes a lot more sense. Just like this woman daily came to get water, drank it, but then woke up the next morning thirsty again and has to go back continually to get water. She has likely gone to the well of men to satisfy the thirst of her soul. We don't know if she was an adulteress, was looking to romance and sex to fulfill her, or if she was looking for security in men in a patriarchal society who kept taking advantage of her and divorcing her, failing to step into their responsibility. Either way, it doesn't matter. Five husbands, a sixth man. Whatever the story, one thing's clear. The well she kept going to never satisfied her soul. Ultimately, it left her thirsty again. One marriage after another, still feeling thirsty. Then she gives up on the institution of marriage altogether because it's not safe for her, or so it seems. But what she does every day with that water pot for her physical thirst, she's doing with relationships for soul thirst. She responds to this, which is, I don't know if you ever thought about this, like, again, Jesus doesn't know her on paper. And he knows her business. It's kind of wild. So I don't know how you would have reacted if a guy walks up. He's like, you have this thing that you're really ashamed of? Bang, there it is, right? You'd be pretty nervous. She says, sir, the woman replied, I see that you are a prophet. It's kind of an understatement. And then she does something that we often do when we feel exposed. I don't know if you've been here before. She says, "Our fathers worship on this mountain, but you Jews say that the place to worship is in Jerusalem." So she asks a random theological question at a really strange time. He's like, "You have this thing you do." And she's like, "Hey, what's going on with like the right temple location? What Bible translation do you use?" And by the way, people do this a lot when they're pressed with the claims of Jesus, even by someone that loves them, or a pastor or evangelist. Like they start to look in the mirror of their own soul and they see the ugliness that's there, right? And some people get defensive, right? Right? "You're confronting me, you're questioning my choices, right? Nope, I'm just telling you what I see. My failure to acknowledge a problem in my life." Again, you know, what about the church's history of hatred towards the LGBTQ community? What about the places the Bible contradicts itself? And it's like, those are great questions. Another great question I have is why you're asking me this right now. I just find it interesting that you're bringing this up right as we found out about whatever it is that you need help with, right? We have a politician or two in our country who do this right now. You might have seen this before. One political strategist calls it the dead cat strategy. And he goes, whatever is happening that doesn't look good, you just pull a dead cat out and you throw it on the table, right? You do something crazy and you change the subject, right? Media shines, whatever it is. And we can do this ourselves. We can have our own internal PR that likes to kind of throw focus, right? What about that person? They're worse than me. But Jesus doesn't let himself get distracted. He lovingly keeps pressing. Verse 21, Jesus told her, "Believe me, woman, an hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know because salvation comes from the Jews. But an hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Yes, the Father wants such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Jesus told her, "I, the one speaking to you, am he." And so this woman who wants to change the subject, Jesus tells this woman, God knows you and he wants to know you in spirit and in truth. He loves you. This woman hasn't lived in truth for a long time. She's hid, going to and from different places at different times to avoid people. But Jesus, in this picture, he tells her that he can satisfy her soul and that he knows everything about her. That he is God in the flesh, essentially. He's the one who's come to redeem everything. And he invites her to join him. Even with all her baggage and all the things about her that would have been marginalized in that society, he moves towards her. Now, this is a big deal for us because we still go back to wells. We still try to find something to satisfy us that never can. I mean, one question is, you know, why do we stay so thirsty for so long? Which leads to my first point, which is we are thirsty. We are thirsty. There's a book called Sipping Saltwater by a counselor and pastor named Steve Hope. And I really like this. He has this thing called the Saltwater Cycle. I've talked about this before in some of our trainings. I think we've got a picture of it. It's called the saltwater cycle. And what he says is that we believe a lie, we drink, and we hurt. And then it reinforces the lie and the drinking and the hurting. And I don't mean drinking as an alcohol. It could be that, by the way. But one of the things that he talks about in his book is salt water is something that is water and it's cold and it looks like it's going to meet the need you have, but it makes you thirstier. Not only does it not quench your thirst, but it makes you even more thirsty. And so there's this idea that we believe a lie, right? Like if you get this relationship, no matter what it costs you, you'll finally feel loved. If you make this much money, you'll finally be secured. If your kid gets into the right program, you'll finally be enough as a parent. If you're sexually free, you'll finally be powerful and happy. And the Bible has, in the Old Testament, we don't have time to get into it, but an analogy for this type of thing is something called an idol. It's something you look to give you what only God can. And in the prophets, there are multiple times where the prophets say, you're going to drink from a well that can't quench your thirst. Or it's a dirty well. It's going to make you sick, but you keep going back. Tim Keller says, an idol is anything that's more important to you than God. Steve Cuss says, an idol is something you think you need that you don't really need to be okay. And so the idea is that we believe, you can keep the salt water cycle up, is we believe that lie, and then we go to drink, right? We go to whatever our well of choice is. So we sleep with that person, we binge that show, we chase that promotion, we grab the phone for another dopamine hit. Some of us, these are our wells. And at first it feels good, and that's the thing with salt water, it tastes like it should work. It's wet, it's cold, but then it dehydrates you, but then you suffer. Right? You hurt. You crash. This is the hangover after the night of binge drinking. This is the guilt that explodes after you give into your anger again or trying to control someone or using pornography or whatever it is. This cycle happens and then it reinforces this pain and you go back for more. Have you ever experienced anything like this? I have to show your hands too much, but yeah, right? One commentator says this. He says, everyone who's consistently looked at porn has experienced this. They believe the lie that sexual fantasy can fulfill. Each look at the screen produces more cravings and less pleasure. And you engage in riskier and riskier behaviors and engage in stuff you never thought you'd do. If you're married, a gap starts to emerge between you and your spouse and you as you keep the secret, as you struggle physically to get aroused, you feel alone, ashamed, and wildly unfulfilled. Everyone who's been addicted to a substance has experienced this, right? There's the, I want to go drink and stuff. I want to go do this thing. But over time, something that you thought would comfort you is making your life very uncomfortable. No one who starts using drugs thinks, I'm going to end up on the street or I'm going to end up alienated from my family. Everyone who's been in a codependent relationship has experienced this. You believe the lie that a person's romantic interest will satisfy you, and so you make sacrifices for them. You compromise your values. And as the relationship gets worse, the feeling of needing the other person gets stronger, even as we experience abuse and manipulation, which is the opposite of true love. But you keep going back for more. If you ever try to find satisfaction in the security of financial planning, what a week. Am I right? Man, 1 Timothy 6 says, don't put your hope in riches, which are so uncertain, but in the God who richly provides, right? Like there's a roller coaster there. And so the root of sin is pursuing happiness in something other than God while rejecting God. And it produces an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. So in other words, it's lie, drink, crash, repeat. But the thing is Jesus wants to set you free from that cycle. Which leads to second to last point here. We drink from the wrong wells, but we're looking for something that's good. Right? So let's say, again, you know, you go, man, I'm going to find my, what I need is work or career. I think we have a list of the wells just to save time. Wells we often drink from today, work or success, right? If I just get this role or this job or this title or whatever it is, I'll finally feel blank. But often you find that, the more successful you are, the more people need things from you. And the only person who can, cap how much work you have is you, but you don't want to do it because you're terrified to. It could be financial security and material possessions, right? If I just had more, whatever it is, or material possessions, right? If I just had this house or more square footage or another fit, another pair of kicks, let's upgrade our car. Why? Just because. Let's upgrade our car because I'm sad, right? And slowly without realizing it, money can become your God. Jesus said, you cannot serve both God and money. I think a lot of us are like, Jesus, I'd like to try. I'd like to try to serve two masters, right? Okay, maybe it's romance and sex. If I just find the right person, But again, we know no human being can carry the weight of your soul. A husband or wife can't. A boyfriend definitely can't, right? Sex can't do it either. There is less taboo around almost every sexual appetite in the world right now, and our mental health is crashing right now, especially for women. One of the, we'll talk about this in a few weeks, but one of the downsides to sex being like not a big deal and it's no big deal is then women get pressured to have sex more than they used to. People forget, you know, purity culture was a bad thing, but when sex was something that was, you know, reserved for marriage or whatever it is, there wasn't this expectation if you went on one date with a guy. But now, again, there's a, you know, ton of editorials written, books, all stuff. There's this idea that now I'm expected to do something I don't want to do. And yeah, consent's, it's great that consent's a barrier, but, you know, you feel pretty pressured when consent, it's like, it's not a big deal. So why wouldn't you consent? Validation, social media, we can go on and on and on. Substances and escape. A lot of us think, man, I work hard, right? I go on working success, but then I'm going to, right, work hard, play hard, right? I'm going to escape, right? Everybody's working for the weekend, right? Like we're doing, again, I dated myself there in a way that's dated myself with my dad. I don't even know. That wasn't like a jam in high school for me, but it is what it is. But we go, I'm going to do that. And we go, you know what? But then I'll get another vacation, right? And there's this leadership guy named Kerry Newhoff. He says, time off won't heal you when the problem is how you spend your days. So it's like how we live our life is the problem. In other words, like what's happening inside of us, not our circumstances, is our biggest problem. And we go, oh, and escaping is just changing your circumstances. But we're kind of like a toddler who buries their face in the couch when they do something bad, right? If I just don't look at dad, I'm not in trouble, right? If I can't see mom, she can't see me, right? But at the end of the day, it doesn't change things. One that's picked up lately is parenting and your own children's success, right? Some of us are drinking from the well of our kids. It's a therapeutic term called consumption. And it's when you use your kid, you consume them to meet your needs when an adult should be meeting the needs of their children primarily. But here's the thing. It's easier to do this than you think. When your child's achievement becomes your identity and what school they get into becomes your identity, or when their sports performance determines your mood, you've made your child into an idol, right? They were never meant to carry the weight of your validation. Some of us don't need our kids to be perfect. We just need to make them feel like we're good parents. We just want them to know that, and they need to tell us that, right? But here's the thing. God has called you to raise your kids, not to worship them or to ask them to worship you. Kids are foolish. Kids are sinful. Kids get sick. You don't have to have the perfect answer for all those things all the time. And they don't need the added pressure of trying to be perfect or help their parent understand exactly why they're doing what they're doing. By the way, parenting is not a chance to give kids what you never got. That's not what it is. Or to right the wrongs of your childhood. Get a therapist for that. Don't get a kid. Don't crush your kids by trying to redeem your childhood at their expense. Give them what they need. But it's hard to do that when you make it your identity. And on it goes. Which leads to where I meant to go a second ago. It's the water that we're really after. The water that we're really after. So a famous quote by a British philosopher named G.K. Chesterton. He said, every time a man knocks on a brothel door, he is really searching for God. The idea behind that is that, man, when someone's going to something sinful and broken, it's not actually the surface. It's the water you're after, not the well. So a guy named Dr. Jerry Wortley, he calls things like these core longings, things like, I have a list of these, identity, am I loved? Security, am I safe? Purpose, do I matter? Connection, do I belong somewhere? Do we have that slide? No. Comfort, how can I feel better? Identity, security, purpose, connection, comfort. These aren't bad things. We're trying to meet legitimate needs in an illegitimate way. Which leads to the last thing. I don't know if we, yeah, at least the last thing is just that Jesus can actually satisfy us. Jesus can actually satisfy us. When we're thirsty for significance, we want to throw ourselves into success and work. We can remember and lean into an experience that our work doesn't define our worth. We can work from significance, not for significance. When you're thirsty for love and belonging and you you want to give yourself over to an unhealthy relationship or sexual sin or porn, whatever it is, you can know the fact that, no, I'm connected to someone who loves me. Yeah, I want relationship is the big idea. And there's someone who wants to connect to me, who loves me, who actually sees me and knows me and loves me more than anyone else ever could. When you're thirsty for approval and you want to kind of wild out on social media and get validation and post a bunch of stuff, to remember that God delights in you. He created all these people you're chasing, whose approval you're chasing. People you don't even like. You just want their heart. You just want their heart. You know, you just want their like or whatever. When we're hurting and we want just to experience comfort, you know, we want to eat too much, eat the wrong stuff. We want to drink a lot. We want to text that person we know we shouldn't text, whatever it is. We want to binge watch a show. We can go back to the fact that we don't have to just take care of ourselves all by ourselves, that Jesus can meet us in it. He doesn't just numb us. He can heal us. He wants to use people. You don't have to do it on your own. One of the things I was going to say is, you know, the saltwater cycle, really, it's like addiction, idolatry, addiction. They're fairly synonymous when you look at them in the Bible, but it's this thing that you can't stop going back to. And what I want you to know is Jesus does want to set you free, but you have to admit, just like any recovery group, you have to admit you have a problem. You have to admit, this is what I do. And Jesus, I need you. And so we would love to help you, by the way. We'd love to help you with that. If you want to talk this week, we'd love to get you connected, whether it's to a pastor, to a counselor. We'd love to like start a journey with you or just to friends in the church who can understand. In my counseling program right now, I'm reading a book called Addiction and Grace by Gerald May. It's an old school book. But in the book, he basically says every human has an addictive personality. We choose what addiction, but we look to something to give us really what only God can. And so where do you turn instead of Jesus is a massive question. The other thing I want to say is for some of us, we've been Christians for a long time and we go, man, Jesus never meets me. He never satisfies me. He's never enough. And the thing I want to say is there could be some truth to times where God feels distant or a dark night of the soul, but also it's hard to enjoy a truly gourmet meal, not like the one at that hotel, a truly gourmet meal when you binge ate Cheetos. You're like, what? It's a metaphor again, like Jesus. I'm using a metaphor. If you let yourself engage the counterfeit, you're not going to appreciate the real thing. You're not going to long for the real thing. You're not going to have the same depth as the real thing. Does that make sense? You can't hold this in your hand. You can't hold all these things in your hand at the same time, and you have to surrender it and lay it down to then pick up what grace has to offer. You can't drink out of two cups of this. You can. It's gonna make a mess, and it won't be very satisfying. And so, for some of us, part of the reality is we need to let go of the thing and start that journey to then realize how much better Jesus is than the thing we're trying to replace him with. And which leads to just a few questions I want to ask as we close. What are you thirsty for? What are you thirsty for? Were you guys able to find that slide with the things we look for? It's okay if not. Also, you guys are so far back, I can't see your faces. So it's okay. But is it for you? Is it connection? Is it approval? Is it significance? Is it security? Is it comfort? You know, what is it for you? And then what well do you keep going back to give you that? There's a place you go to drink And then you find out, oh, it's not the real thing. Oh, there we go. Yeah. So again, what water are you after? Take a picture of that if you want to. We'll send it out in an email as well. But is it identity, security, purpose, connection, comfort? So what are you thirsty for? To what well do you keep going back to? What's the thing you look to give you these things besides Jesus? And then number three, will you let Jesus satisfy you? Will you let Jesus satisfy you? Right now, I'm going to call the worship team up. We'll move into worship. One of the things that Jesus says is, whoever drinks from this water I give will never thirst again. He's making a claim there that he can satisfy every desire of the human heart. It's a massive claim. And so I want to put that in front of you. Man, come drink as we worship. Worship deeply. What this can look like in your life is so significant. You don't stop caring about work, but you stop needing it. You stop needing it to prove your value and worth. You don't stop loving your family, but you stop worshiping them. You don't stop enjoying good things, but you stop demanding them to make you feel better all the time. As we go into worship as well, one of the other things that's really remarkable about this passage is that this woman who did not want people to see her, did not want to make eye contact, wanted to avoid her, all that stuff. It says that she was excited to tell the people who had rejected her that she found someone who knew everything about her and loved her anyways. Isn't that crazy? And so in the same way, Jesus sends us out as he meets us in our, wherever we're at, he meets us in it. And he begins to satisfy. And then he sends out those who have been satisfied. And so I love with you, I'd love to put these questions up again as we go into worship. Again, I'd love for you to sit with these for a second before we go into musical worship. Pray through these just a few minutes. Again, what are you thirsty for? What well do you keep going back to? And will you let Jesus satisfy you? And a key to that third question is you've got to ask him. You have to actually get help to turn from the thing, and then you've got to actually turn to him. Also, I want to encourage you, just like she went out to share in the chairs in front of your seats, like Grant mentioned, there's Easter, kind of like club card things. So I would encourage you to invite people out to Easter in the same way that this woman went out to share her story. I'd encourage you to do that this week, but I'll pray. We'll sit with these for a minute or two, and we'll go into musical worship, and we'll have communion, and we'll close. Jesus, would you teach us how to have our thirst quenched by the real thing? This picture of driving across the country and going to like a dingy gas station with terrible coffee and drinking that in the middle of the desert instead of cold water. Not for many of us, that's what we go back to over and over and over. And the consequences come and the shame comes and the alienation comes. You long to be close to us, and we feel like we can't get close to you because of shame or fear or guilt. Can't get close to the people around us. But Lord, would you instill hope today that we can be honest about where we are? To some of the men and women in this room, ultimately to you. And secondly, would you give us hope that you really can satisfy if we come to the real thing? And so, Lord, would you teach us to quench our thirst, to find our identity in you, our security in you, our purpose in you, our comfort in you, first and foremost. And then everything else is just grace. It's just gravy. It's on top. It's the cherry on top to what Jesus has given us. And so, Lord, would you teach us to quench our thirst? And it's in your name we pray. Amen. So yeah, I would just encourage you to sit with these questions for a few, and then in about 2 minutes, if you're willing and able, we'll stand up, we'll have two songs, and then we'll take communion. But I encourage you to sit with these for just a moment.